38. By 8 we were on the move. The morning was clear and fresh, but was bound to heat up later. The man from Amadeus sat between Arcady and Marion, clinging to the briefcase. Limpy, spruced up for the occasion, sat with me in the back. We headed out towards the scene of my abortive kangaroo hunt, but then turned left along the back road to Alice. After about 10 miles, the country changed from the yellow flowering scrub to a rolling open parkland of bleached grass and rounded eucalyptus trees, blue-green, the colour of olives with their leaves turning white in the wind. And if you soft-focused your eyes, you'd think you were in the lit-up Provençal landscape of Van Gogh's cornfield near Arles. We crossed a creek and took another left along a sandy track. There was a neat corrugated shack set in a spinney of trees, and also Titus's Ford. A woman jumped to her feet and ran off. The dogs, as usual, howled. Titus, in shorts and a pork pie hat, sat in front of a boiling billy on a pink foam rubber mat. His father, a handsome leggy old man with a covering of inch-long grey bristles, was stretched out in the dust, smiling.
"You're early," said Titus gravely. "I wasn't expecting you before 9.
He amazed me by his ugliness. The spread of his nose, the wens that covered his forehead, the fleshy down-hanging lip, and eyes that were hooded by the folds of his eyelids. But what a face! You never saw a face of such mobility and character. Every scrap of it was in a state of perpetual animation. One second, he was an unbending aboriginal lawman. The next, an outrageous comic. "Titus," said Arcady, "this is a friend of mine from England, Bruce."
"Oh, the Thatcher," he drawled.
"Still there," I said.
"Can't say I care for the woman."
He looked up at Marion and said,
"I know you, don't I?"
"But what you didn't know," Arcady chipped in, "is that she's been my wife for 4 days.
"Nights, you mean,"
said Titus.
"I do."
"Very pleased to hear it," he said.
"A lad like you needs a sensible wife."
"I do,"
repeated Arcady and hugged her. Arcady felt the time had come to introduce the man from Amadeus, but Titus raised his hand and said,
"Wait."
He unpadlocked the door of the shack, leaving it half ajar, and got out a blue enamel mug for the extra visitor. The tea was ready.
"Sugar?"
he asked me. "No, thanks."
"No,"
he winked.
"I didn't think you looked the type."
Once we had finished tea, he jumped up and said,
"Right, to business."
He beckoned Limpy and the man from Amadeus to go on ahead. He then swiveled round to face us.
"Your mob," he said, "you'd be doing me a favour if you'd stay right here for 30 minutes.
The dead twigs crackled underfoot, and the men were swallowed up among the trees. The old father lay there beaming and dozed off to sleep. A churinga, it is worthwhile repeating, is an oval plaque made of stone or mulga wood. It is both musical score and mythological guide to the ancestor's travels. It is the actual body of the ancestor, pars pro toto. It is a man's alter ego, his soul, his arbor to Karen, his title deed to country, his passport and his ticket back in. Strelo gives a harrowing account of some elders who discover their churinga storehouse has been raided by white men, and for whom this is the end of the world. He gives a joyful description of some other old men who have lent their churingas to the neighbours for a number of years, and who, when they unwrap them on their return, break into a peal of happy song. I have also read an account of how, when a song cycle was sung in its entirety, the owners would lay out their churingas end to end, in order, like the order of sleeping cars on the Train Bleu. On the other hand, if you smashed or lost your churinga, you were beyond the human pale, and had lost all hope of returning. Of one young layabout in Alice, I heard it said, "He hasn't seen his churinga. He doesn't know who he is." In the Gilgamesh epic, by way of extra comment, there is a strange passage in which Gilgamesh the king, weary of life, wishes to visit the underworld to see his dead friend, the wild man, Enkidu. But the ferryman, Utnapishtim, says, "No, you may not enter these regions. You have broken the tablets of stone." Arcady was peering through the door of Titus's shack.
Don't, whatever you do, go in.
He spoke through his teeth.
But if you take a look in here, you may see something that'll surprise you.
I eased back on my haunches and peered in. It took time for my eyes to get used to the dark. On a chest beside Titus's bed was a stack of books, in English and German. On top of the pile was Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Yes, I nodded, I am very surprised.
In less than half an hour, we heard a whistle through the trees and watched the three men stepping towards us in single file.
Business settled,
said Titus, firmly, and sat down on his mat.
Thuringia's returned to their rightful owners.
The man from Amadeus looked relieved. The conversation turned to other things. Titus was the terror of the land rights movement, because whatever he had to say was bound to be original and uncalled for. He explained how, to the people of his grandparents' generation, the outlook had been infinitely bleaker than it was today. Watching their sons go to pieces, the elders had frequently handed their Thuringias to the missionaries to prevent them being broken, lost, or sold. One man worthy of their trust was the pastor of the Horn River Mission, Klaus Peter Auricht.
My grandfather, Titus said, gave several Thuringias to old Auricht, when this one, he jerked his head at his snoring father, got taken with the booze.
Before dying in the late 1960s, Pastor Auricht had taken the collection to the mission's headquarters in Alice, where it was kept under lock and key. When the activists got wind of the fact that Germans were sitting on sacred property worth millions, they raised the usual ballyhoo and lobbied for their return to the people.
What the fuckers don't understand, drawled Titus, is there is no such person as an aboriginal or an aborigine. There are Chakamaras and Jabarulas and Dubarungas like me, and so on all over the country. But if Leslie Watson, he went on, and that Canberra mob so much as took one peep at my family's Thuringias, and if we're applying law to this situation, I'd be obliged to spear 'em, wouldn't I?
Titus shook with laughter, and we all did.
I have to tell you, he wheezed with a wicked grin, that since I saw you last, I've had some very funny visitors.
The first were some young architects who wanted, in the name of the Pintupi Council and in the hope of shutting his mouth, to build him a house. Titus snorted.
They had in mind some kind of flat-roofed humpy, fuckers. I told them if I was going to have a house, I wanted a house with a gable roof. I needed a library for my books, living room, spare bedroom, outside kitchen and shower, otherwise I'd stay right here.
The next one had been even funnier, a glib-talking individual from the mining corporation, which wanted to run seismic lines through Titus's country.
Bastard, he said. Shows me his geological survey map, which, I might add, he's obliged to by the law of the Crown, and spouts a bunch of total garbage. Here, I say, give that to me. I take a look at his sink lines, and I have to say there's a fair chance of oil or natural gas over by Hunter's Bluff, but look here, I say, we have different ways of looking at this. We've got a lot of important dreamings in the area. We've got native cat. We've got emu, black cockatoo, budgerigar, two kinds of lizard, and we've got an eternal home for big kangaroo. At a guess, I'd say he was your oil field or whatever, but he's been sleeping there since the dream time, and, if I have a say in the matter, he's going to go on sleeping forever.
Titus really enjoyed our visit. We had a lot more laughs. Even the po-faced man from Amadeus laughed. Then we piled into the land cruiser and hurried back to Cullen. I spent the afternoon clearing up my papers. We were starting for Alice in the morning.